We have. Okay, so this evening is our second class in a series of four on this book, Illumination by Rebecca Lee, A Guide to the Buddhist Method of No Method, or the guide to our form of meditation. But even what she talks about in this book really isn't limited just to meditation. So the last class was on the first several chapters where she talked about this silent illumination is the Chan term for our meditation practice. And so if you're curious at all, you weren't at that class and you want to go back and listen to it, all of our classes are recorded and then they're posted to our website. So if you go to, I think it's resources, audio and video. And so if you're curious, you can listen to that. But I do really recommend, I recommend this book. If you missed the title of it, it's all on the website under our Tuesday class series. It comes out in our newsletter. It's a great book, and we're going very quickly through it because our precept study classes begin in March. And so we didn't, I only had four classes that I could do on this book. So I'm not doing it. We're not like able to cover every detail of it, all the good stuff in it. Which also reminds me, this will come out in the newsletter, but I want the main book for the precept classes to be the relatively new one by, get her first name, but Mujo is her Dharma name and Baker is her last name. I think it's Nancy Mujo.
Nancy, yeah.
And it's Opening to Oneness. And this will all get posted to our website as well. Those of you who are leading precept classes, that doesn't mean you have to, just use that book or something, but that's going to be the one that I recommend everybody read this time if they want to be studying a precept text. So, anyway, heads up about that series starting. So this tonight, we are beginning the next three classes then. We are talking about what Rebecca Lee calls the modes of operation. So she was talking about silent illumination as this very deceptively simple practice we have of what I say, just making peace with yourself, making time and space to just make peace with yourself and be present for your life just as it is, setting aside any effort to control or figure out or judge and just be with. So she talks about how the way that our practice works, it's not a matter of practicing it like a skill and getting good at it and building up your concentration. And it's not a matter of working really hard at it until you get better at it. It's the obstacles we encounter in this practice are very fundamental to our being. They are craving, aversion, and ignorance, sometimes called greed, hate, and delusion, right? The reasons we cannot just sit there and be completely content with our life just as it is and alert and present for it. I was talking to Claire tonight at the intro of like, imagine. You are, because a lot of times we'll say, okay, we know all these things we're not supposed to do when we're sitting there, but what are we supposed to do? Because sometimes, okay, you let go of this, you let go of thinking about that, but then, okay, what? So I'd say, imagine you are, I could probably come up with a better like analogy for this, but imagine you're sitting in the woods at night and it's dark and like you think wild creatures might come. Like, that kind of alertness, just like general wide open alertness. Like, we don't know what's going to happen next. Anything could happen. That kind of engagement with this moment is what we are looking for. At that, if you were sitting like that, you would not be you would not be thinking like, what should I concentrate on? Should I listen? Should I concentrate on my body sensations? Am I being mind? Like, you would just naturally, you just, your awareness is open. You're just waiting and alert. Yoli.
So, like, I sometimes, when I'm sitting there, sometimes noises will startle me, which leads me to think that I'm not present, correct? Because I should not be startled by noise. It's not always, but.
I wouldn't say like, again, when we ever get into shoulds or shouldn'ts, it's just like, well,
Because I'm like lost in
that's just what it
thought.
is. But I do think, because like she talks about a lot in this book, and it's great. She talks about not judging our meditation. But I feel like when I'm really present like that, rather than, in many traditions where if you're deep in meditation, you might just like be totally like absorbed and not even aware of things going on around you or something. Like, this is totally different. I feel like when I am really there, that if, like, I don't know, something happened over there, like somebody fainted, needed help or something, I would just like, yeah, like you said, I think that's a good. If we're startled, there's some part of us that has withdrawn in rather than just being like totally open and receptive.
We can take another question.
Sure.
Don't just go there.
Yeah, just in case.
It's a very quick question.
And that is, it is that if you are in that, what I would call heightened state of awareness, is that an accurate description?
That's only, it's heightened in the sense that it's more aware than we usually are.
Right. So if you are that way, are you relaxed?
Yes. So that's where I'm like, the whole nighttime a scary creature might come out. It's probably not the best analogy. But like, I don't know. Like, you think something might happen. So not like a negative scary thing. But just we really don't know what might happen next. So yeah. And I, a better analogy, I guess, I think I imagine being, the 2-year-old in a sunny field who's just like full of wonder. They don't know what's gonna happen next. They're like, oh, they're just wide open, waiting for like, oh, what was that? Look at the, what's that thing? That's the kind of state of wonder that we're looking for. Courtney.
I was just going to say that what I think of it as is the word that the what I use is curiosity. That I have this open curiosity of like what's going to happen. And that was that what I was talking about last week. Like the first time I heard about this, I was like, I came in with this sense of like, oh, I wonder what's going to happen if I do that, like if I meditate that way. So
Yeah.
really, curiosity is the word that helps me to find that place.
And that's why we talk about, it's oftentimes said, we talk about the beginner's mind, right? The very first time you do this, you're like, what's going to happen? I remember when I first read, oh, okay, I'm supposed to sit on the floor, look at the wall. Huh. And I just sat there and it was like totally far out. Just, whoa. And then, quickly ceases to be that way because then I have some idea about how it's supposed to go or what I'm supposed to be doing or something like that. But, Rachel.
I have a question. In the book, she keeps mentioning that you're not supposed to react, but you're supposed to observe. But I'm not exactly sure if I'm doing it right because when I observe, it's like, that's an angry thought, and then I just leave it alone. But I don't know if that's like a reaction or not. Like, what does she mean by reaction, and what does she mean by observation? Can you give me some advice?
Good question. I guess it's like, it depends on the kind of the feeling tone and agenda behind the noticing. Because I think that can be a very useful exercise in a way. I actually find that noticing and very lightly labeling is a way for us to actually acknowledge what has arisen and not like brush it away or judge it too fast. So it can be, if we do it very gently and like without being bothered, right? As opposed to like, oh, there's an angry thought, you know, and now I either don't like that or I want to get rid of it or something like she talks about tonight. But it's really just like, you know, with that curiosity, that's this weird, like it's possible to be kind of strangely objective about ourselves and what's happening. I mean, really, it's this whole process is tied up with our all the other aspects of our practice. Self-acceptance, you know, working with the precepts, all of it. And like, I don't know, early on in my practice, if I noticed the way that my mind would be, or like she talks tonight about drowsiness, and I would just, I was encouraged by my teachers to just allow it to be, to not judge it. I'm like, are you kidding? I can't, how can I not judge this? I'm trying to meditate. I'm just sleeping and like, or, you know, the negative thoughts, or I'm just, I can just keep on getting on these, you know, I can't start thinking about my pointless projects. Some of you have heard me say like earlier on, I would design shelving in my zazen. It's like my mind just could not, it was like, no, this is not acceptable just sitting here. So we'll just have to come up with something to do. So I would come up with some space that wasn't being used efficiently, and I would design shelving for it, which I never, ever, ever built. And so when I would notice myself doing that, I would feel very frustrated. Like, I can't stop this. This is not how I want to be spending my time, whatever. But that's still like, I'm very worried about myself. I'm very concerned about myself. It's still very self-focused, where now it's a little bit more like, I don't know. That's not me. I'm not like, and I'm not, I am also not the one trying to meditate. There is no I. There's just like a strange committee in here, which is just riding this karmic wave. And I ended up with this busy mind, and so what? Like, and so I really like how she talks about it. If we're not, we're not bothered by that.
Identified.
Not identified with or bothered by it. Like, so what? It's not, the Buddha did not say, I have discovered the way to true happiness and peace of mind, and that is to have no thoughts. No thoughts or feelings or sensations. He didn't say that, right? He said, just give up your wanting things to be otherwise. So hopefully that answers your question. So I've already touched on a few of these things here then. I really like her explanation of the modes. So the basic vexations are that like craving, aversion, and ignorance. But she, and we're going to talk about craving and aversion tonight. But then the next class will be other modes. What gets a little more complicated, kind of like our precepts. You know, we have the pure precepts, and then you got to break it down a little more. Trance, problem solving, and intellectualizing. And I haven't read all of these yet, but I was just kind of, because I was saying tonight, going to suggest to you all that as you go through the class, as you read, kind of identify like, you know, which mode or couple modes are really where you get stuck. And I just briefly looked over and I'm like, that might be problem solving, but then I'm no. And then I went to the next chapter, the intellectualizing mode. Oh, okay. Concepts, ideas, we love them. Yeah. And then the fourth class will be on quietism and forgetting hyphen emptiness. And then the last chapter, we'll also talk about the allowing what is and being fully here. So she kind of brings it back around to what it is we're trying to do. So it's helpful to study the self and get to know which of these modes really tend to get you. And I don't, when she goes into the modes, she goes into some of like, maybe like where they come from or what you might be thinking behind them. And I don't think it's necessary that you necessarily relate to the way that she's seeing it or framing it. The mode, you know, you can still identify with the mode or recognize it's an issue for you, whether you agree with her whole take or not. And she talks about how these modes manifest on and off the meditation seat, but how when we are sitting is an opportunity to really see this clearly, see these a little bit more clearly. I mean, they arise plenty of like throughout the day, but when we sit, so I like to say when how you sit zazen is how you do everything. So whatever it is that tends to happen for you on the meditation seat tends to reflect how you approach your whole life. And I don't, I mean, we try to, ideally we're not like I said, not judgmental and hard on ourselves about that. It's just each of us has our karma. So there it is. So craving and aversion tonight, they're pretty basic. And I think we all experience these. So even if there's some other mode which you find yourself in, I mean, craving and aversion is pretty general. So just to read a little bit of how she describes craving. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'm going to do a little bit, try not to go too long, talk a little about craving and then a little bit about aversion. And then I'm going to kind of talk about how she recommended practicing with both of them, because in a way there's an overlap in the way that you might respond to them. So she says craving, and so first of all, we're talking about craving in the context of meditation practice. And then she talks about it in the context of life as well. Very often when I ask my students how their meditation practice is going, they tell me that their sitting meditation is not very good. I ask them how they arrived at this assessment. For their meditation session to be not good, there must be a reference point against which they are judging it. These practitioners talk about how they had an extremely peaceful meditation session in the past. Sometimes years ago, and other times earlier in the day, and they have been trying to return to or recreate that meditative experience. And she does talk later on about like, the same thing applies if you feel like you've never had that really cool meditative experience, but you heard about it and you really want it. So does that sound familiar? It is quite common. When these practitioners began meditation without any preconceived notion, so they were able to sit and stay with the method. With this beginner's mind, they experienced a calm and clarity they had never experienced before. They may have felt the burden of body and mind disappear during those moments. It was pleasurable, and these practitioners believed that was how a good sitting meditation session is supposed to be. After tasting this enjoyable calm and relaxation, they wanted, craved more of it. They then spent their time in sitting meditation trying to return to that experience. Instead of re-experiencing what they once felt, which can never truly happen, they are left with the feeling that their sitting meditation is never good enough. So, why would craving of more of what we like lead to suffering? Because every moment is the coming together of causes and conditions, including the calm and peace we experience in meditation. Since these causes and conditions are constantly changing, every moment is brand new. So by definition, our Zazen practice, what we're trying to do, I guess, like making peace with ourselves, being fully present with our life just as it is, kind of by definition cannot be a recreation of anything, right? It's not like a state that we attained once and we try to attain again. It's like, it's being with this moment and, you know, this body and this life, not trying to attain anything other than just this. This is not easy to do because of the way that we get caught up. And in particular, right now, we're talking about craving. I mean, I go to meditation retreats. I've done dozens and dozens of them. I've been doing them for 20 plus years. I don't get caught as often now, but I mean, I'll still find myself, you know, partway through a meditation retreat. And I've, you know, I've had some meditation sessions that, like, I kind of, it's like, yeah, okay, this is cool, you know. And then it's crap again. And then it's just like, it's stuck. It just feels stuck. And it's hard. And I just feel tired. And then I'll just realize I'm sitting there trying to make that same thing happen. I'm trying to, like, yeah, that was cool. Because what I did is I centered myself. And then I was just like, I breathed into the present moment. And then, like, so I'm going like, no, you know, and realizing, like, this is not about attaining, you know, making anything happen. Like, just be here. And then I'll be like, you know, momentarily then I have access to it again, right? Because I'm not trying to do anything. So then she talks about the same craving approach. Same craving can happen in our everyday life. I love the example of, you know, being on vacation and, you know, it's so lovely. It's so beautiful. And then as soon as you're there, you're thinking like, I need more of this. I need to do this more often in my life. I bet I could come out here again. You know, like planning the next vacation so that we can get more vacation, or like, you know, trying to like make everything happen exactly the way it should so that, you know, you get the most out of it, and all these ways of craving arises like that. And talks about craving in relationships, you know, where you gave the example of like an adult with a child, and, you know, looking back to times when you had this, you know, innocent child, and this is how the child should be, and then, you know, wishing for that time, and then feeling like the child isn't acting the way that they should. So yeah, the craving being, yeah, think of it as, like she described, it's not, it's dissatisfaction with the present moment and the way things are because of our sense that somewhere else, some other time, some other set of conditions is what we really want. And then kind of the converse of this is the aversion. And aversion, so this is subtle because sometimes, like, you could be craving to be free of thoughts, and or are you averse to thoughts? And they have a little bit of different feeling tones. So you said aversion in meditation. Aversion mode is activated when we turn something that is happening in the present moment into an enemy and set out to remove it from our awareness. Forgetting that thoughts or sensations are a natural part of the meditation experience, we try to get rid of them, agitating the mind in the process. One of the most common responses to why we meditate is the desire to eradicate unpleasant thoughts that disturb us, unpleasant thoughts or feelings or emotions. Often people tell me that they hate the angry thoughts and disagreeable experiences that come up when they meditate. Some are tired of the critical voice in their minds. They believe these thoughts should not be there. They want to have a calm mind, either without thoughts or with only pleasant ones. They believe thoughts are intruders, enemies of the silence they are working hard to attain. Without clarity, they are unable to see that their habit of hating thoughts, treating them as an enemy, and attempting to reject them is what agitates the mind. There is neither silence nor illumination. So he talks about this as being like a warrior stance against thoughts. And then aversion in daily life. This is kind of where the tends to flare up into anger, you know, that kind of making the enemy. That can be other people. It can be, you know, we blame other people, but it can be much more much more vague than that. Like, I don't tend to get angry at people. It doesn't come out that way, but I get infuriated at just like the universe. It's just getting in my way. It's just, you know, the universe that makes printers fail, you know, right when you really need them. The universe that, you know, design tech support, the universe that, you know, just like, you know, designed it so the stoplights that are supposed to, you know, turn green and like keep the traffic flowing turn red when as soon as you get there, that kind of thing. Like, you know, so the anger doesn't have to make sense, doesn't have to have an explicit, you know, object, but it's just, this is how we respond. It's like a, beware of the habitual thought pattern of defining those who are seen as disturbing our idea of how the world is supposed to be as an enemy that should be eliminated. This habit can compel us to justify aggressive and violent responses to our world's problems. If we are habituated to reacting to undesirable thoughts in our meditation by activating the aversion mode, we may inadvertently be reinforcing the habit of rejecting what we dislike. Even though we may believe in working together to improve the lives of everyone in our society and bring peace to the world, instead of listening to where others may be coming from and recognizing their concerns, we can develop a hateful mind toward the people we perceive as obstacles to our well-intentioned actions to make the world a better place. Without being aware of our tendency to fall into aversion mode, we may be contributing to the problems of the world instead of solving them. And then she talks about aversion to the body, to our physical experience, to pain, to mortality, and how this blocks our experience of the present moment. So, just briefly, so that we hopefully have a little time for discussion. How to work with these things? She calls it befriending our modes. She phrased it. She says, when I tell my students this, they often respond with surprise, but I mean it. Befriend them in the sense that you allow them to be there. It is the letting through, the letting be in the practice of silent illumination. After all, they are the thoughts that show up in your mind, your feelings, stories, theories, beliefs, worldviews, values, and desires. They are part of the present moment experience of being you. By making friends with your modes of operation instead of hating and fighting against them, the mind is not agitated and remains clear. The clarity of mind allows you to become familiar with their pattern, so you can recognize them readily. And knowing the habits well means that by cultivating total clear awareness moment after moment after moment, every time something triggers your habitual reactivities, you notice it first and you respond with, for example, I like this one. I notice that whenever my neighbor brags about her life, I want mine to be better and I feel inadequate. That is self-knowledge. And many people never even arrive there. They just feel inadequate and get mad out of the blue about how their life, which a moment ago was fine, is suddenly not good enough. We can unlearn these helpful, unhelpful habits by noticing the thoughts as they arise and fully experiencing the feelings that accompany them without acting out the compulsion to go down the well-trodden paths of suffering. So the essence of, you know, working with all of this, right, is allowing. It's like this whole approach of silent illumination that we take in our meditation, just sitting and being, shining the light of awareness, allowing things to be, expanding that awareness to include anything that arises. Nothing, there's nothing that is not part of what is this moment. That's what we do over the course of our lives as well. As things arise, as we notice these ourselves getting caught up in these modes, we become more familiar with them. Get to know ourselves better. This is Dogen studying the self. See more clearly. Broaden our perspective. Notice outdated strategies. And this clarity only comes without picking and choosing, without that judgment, without trying to push things away or grasp things. That's the only way that we really see what is going on. So I love the fact that Zen is, I mean, there's a time and a place for trying to act in a particular way. It's valuable. I mean, that's what we do for the sake of self and others, to try not to unleash our anger, to try not to steal, to try, you know, to drop our bad habits, that kind of effortful change. But that's not, that's an important aspect, but we view it as like, that's like treating the symptoms. It's not really lasting transformative change, because all of that, you know, our habit energy, all of our karma is still there, driving us toward these modes and these ways of being. It's just clearly seeing what's going on. We get these insights like, why do I do that? Whenever I do that, I end up unhappy. Like, I wonder what else I could do. Just after, and slowly but surely, these insights come, our perspective changes, and things change. But I love how she describes, you're working with habits, if you believe the belief that if you notice a habit and let it go, it will be gone forever, has to do with a lack of understanding of how entrenched habitual tendencies work. The habits that propel our lives are like cars we have driven, but are driving at full speed for decades. When you take your foot off the gas pedal, does the car just stop moving right away? Well, mine does. Electric car, just had to throw that in there. When you take your foot off the gas pedal, does the car just stop moving right away? No, it will keep going for a while as there is a lot of momentum and residual energy propelling the vehicle forward. Chances are you will still notice the compulsion of craving arising when you experience something pleasant. You will notice that in certain moments, especially when you are not really with your practice, like when you're tired or when your concentration has weakened, you are prone to succumb to the pull of these entrenched habits. In these moments, it is easy for your default modes of operation to be activated. But we just keep on over and over trying to cultivate that clear awareness. And that's what allows the gradual change. So I will leave it there. It really hardly did justice. We could have done one chapter, a whole class, but there you go. Questions or comments? Would you mind coming up and sitting in this chair?
Okay.
I know it's awkward, but that lets the people online hear you.
Well, I have the reason I got to
just here tonight, and the I had an experience. I read Jordan Brewer's book, Unwinding Anxiety. Mm-hmm. He is at Brown University. He's a psychiatrist. He's done all the research in anxiety. And he's also a Buddhist. He has practiced meditation, and a lot of the things that he does to help people change their patterns of anxiety are exactly what Rebecca Lee is talking about, and Susan Murphy, and so on and so on. So I had this experience, and I've had it for years. Every time I have to have I go to a doctor, my blood pressure is sky high. And I know, and it's not that way when I'm at home, and it's humiliating to go in there and not to be able to control my blood pressure, and I feel like you know, I've tried all kinds of substitute thinking, you know, think of something, you know, that was really pleasant or yeah, or a beautiful scene, and none of it has ever worked. So he says two things. He says, don't try to change it. Don't try to fix it. And just stay with the present moment. And so I was going to my electrophysiologist, because I have a pacemaker in my heart. So, and if my blood pressure is high, then I get this lecture, you know, about, we've got to manage this, yeah, and you know, and it's not a problem. And I said, okay. And I knew it was high as I was going, and I was going to OSSU. So I got on the max, and I said, time to practice this. And so I just kept very present in my situation. And, you know, I watched the trees and the sky, and then I watched people coming in and off, and my reaction to them and what they were wearing. And then I got off, and I was in the rain, and I got on the trolley. And then when he was taking the technician was taking my blood pressure, he was talking about his mother, and I just focused on him and what he was saying about his mother, and my blood pressure was normal. Oh, okay. And I said to myself, wow, I mean, how could this have happened? You know, and then I was reading Susan Murphy's book, that the fire, anyway, she writes on Zen codes and eco-psychology and so on and so forth. But she said something, and that touched it off. She said, you know, that we must rely on staying in the present moment and trusting that the present moment contains all we need. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, I have never trusted the present moment to be able to meet my needs. I've always thought that, you know, I have to fix it or I have to do something, you know, and that was so powerful to think, you know, that just by staying in the present moment, I could change something, you know. Yeah, that was powerful. Mm. And so then I read Rebecca Lee, and I realized that, you know, that she's saying the same thing, but in a, you know, yeah. So that's all.
Thank you. I mean, that really reminds me of how, you know, this practice, this, which we really practice explicitly when we're meditating or not meditating, as I like to say, but we do it at all times, it's not a matter of like something that we do because it has a positive effect. You know, it's not like I meditate in order to become calm, kind of thing. Sometimes we might not. It's like, it's totally existential. It really, like, it's a challenge to us as beings to, can, like you said, that can we trust this present moment instead of this grasping and aversion and all of these other modes that she's talking about getting in. This has to do with our very foundational sense of ourselves and our relationship to life. And I mean, I'm always like, I feel responsible. I'm a very responsible person. I'm responsible for that. I'm responsible for that. If I see that being, that's broken, that needs to be fixed. I'm not saying like you should fix it. I'm like, I should probably do that too. Like, I'm just, so I just see the world as a bunch of problems that need to be fixed. And I, you know, a lot of times I enjoy it, but then sometimes it's like, I, you know, I get frazzled and I'm no good at it. And then resting in that moment, realizing like, I'm not, there's no me who is responsible. Like, look at all the people who are feeding me and taking care of me and like keeping the lights on and the people who emotionally support me. And like, you know, I do my podcast, but you know, somebody maintains the servers and the computers. And I mean, I'm being supported on in infinitely many ways just to even fulfill whatever role I'm filling, so that we're actually being supported on all sides. And we can certainly let go of whatever our default mode is for like, you know, a half an hour at a time and things aren't going to fall apart. So yeah. Lydia.
Yeah, I just like to share an area of my life that is not successful and not yet, not successfully accessed, I guess, by silent illumination. And it's really frustrating, but I have to believe that someday I will be able to tackle this. And it is a feeling of, I guess this is a craving. I think it falls under craving, not aversion, but craving. When I see other people, it sounds so shallow. It's see other people like posting on Facebook or, you know, in those Christmas letters you get telling about their lives or whatever, about their children and grandchildren. And I just feel, I don't know, it's almost like this sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. And I've tried to sit with it and just allow it in to the room and say, hello, sick, envious feeling. You know, here you are. I have one child and she is not going to reproduce, that's for sure. She was not able to graduate from college. She has some disabilities. So I don't know. That's just one of those things where it's like, I know that in the future, this may change, but as it is, this is somebody I can't, you know, let into the room just yet. And there's probably other people who may be feeling like I do, where it's like, well, this is all very nice to say that I can how invite all these thoughts in and just observe them and, you know, everything like that. It, sometimes there's real, you know, there's real deep, I hate to label this with trauma, but, you know, for some people, there are some really deep feelings that they just, the negative feelings, that sick feeling in the pit of your stomach just happens before you even have a chance to be aware that it's even there. So anyway, I just thought I'd share that little piece. I'm hoping this book will help.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it requires a lot of patience and faith in the path. So I feel like, I don't know. I was very fortunate, but I think I share this experience with many people that when I first started practicing, I was able to change quite a number of things. Like I was able to like really, you know, this really made a difference in my life. But it was like, those are the easy things. Apparently those are the easy things to change. And then there were like the resistant ones that like stick around, and I can feel a sense of frustration or impatience or failure about like what about that? But I got this visualization of kind of taking it and putting it on the back burner. So it's like you don't give up, you don't completely forget about it, but you also realize, well, that one doesn't seem to be ready yet to budge, right? So I wonder when. And it's really like, I mean, in my experience, and I think, and many people who have been practicing for a long time, like if you keep it up and you don't give up that gentle aspiration, like there will be a time. I mean, it could be 1 year from now, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. I mean, really, when you think about this, I mean, who cares if it's 20 years from now, it's still worth it. If 20 years from now, you're like, ah, you know, I don't know, to read that Christmas letter and go like, good for you. And then you recognize like, wow, I'm free of that, you know? But our karma is complicated and
You know, I have one thing to add to that, and that is when I'm in that situation, I re try to remember to just have immense self-compassion for myself. Because so we're not going to change all our habits. It's going to take time. And as you said, patience. But the fact that, you know, I'm affected, and we all are, by our conditioning, and some of our conditioning and the way we grew up and the things that we had to do to protect ourselves, it definitely are there. And we really need to just give ourselves so much kindness and self-compassion for this. I mean, yes, maybe we would like to change it, but before that, we just have to, yes, that is there, and really just honor that. Yeah.
And that ties in with, you know, what Rebecca Lee was saying, which is, you know, we include that too. I mean, I don't know about you, but I do have this sense that, well, if I apply the practice, you know, if I stop and breathe and I do the silent illumination, then like all the icky stuff will go away and I'll be at peace. But it's like, no, that's not what it says, right? It's like, at the moment, it may just be, you know, even just recognizing I have these thoughts and feelings, and then expanding the awareness and recognizing I have this frustration and shame and judgment about even having those feelings. That's all just part of it. All right, well, that brings us to the end. Offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thanks for being here,
Bye, everyone.
everybody.